KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Daly City.
Glenmore in Fremont.
East Bay, El Cerrito.
West Oakland.
Coming up, an iconic symbol of San Francisco is shutting down.
This store will save you. You break something, you run in here real fast, pick it up. Then you finish the gig.
The Haight-Ashbury Music Center is going out of business, but the Bay Area is still home to many people who make music and instruments. We'll meet one who fixes some of the world's most valuable guitars.
Those are actually the moments that I live for, to hear people playing these instruments.
And we'll talk with a San Franciscan dedicated to promoting craftsmanship around the world.
I would like to see people return to the notion of buying something that is meant to last.
Art and the people who make it possible. Today on Cross Currents, stay with us. The Haight-Ashbury Music Center is selling off its gear. The store has been around for some 40 years. It was opened by the brother of Janis Joplin's bassist, and it's been a centerpiece of the Haight Street experience ever since. So what happens when a place known for culture and counterculture loses its music? KALW's Ariella Markowitz went to the going out of business sale last week to find out.
Is it okay to pick up a guitar? Absolutely.
My name is Masood Badakhshan, and I've been running this store for the last 40 years. I'm glad I had the chance to be part of San Francisco's history, especially Haight-Ashbury, which is really has always been in my heart. I hitchhiked in 1969 from Iran to come here. Well, it wasn't such a great music store when I scored it. But, you know, it's a labor of love, seriously it is. Unfortunately, the times are changing, so I had a good run. And I'm gonna miss my customer, I'm gonna miss the people I work with. Two doors down is Jimi Hendrix's Red House. Janis Joplin lived there. Jim Morrison lived there. I met so many of my idols in this store.
All right, one mini Strat. $20 off. And for the gig bag, $163.81 is your grand total. All right.
I'm Ruben Trejo from San Francisco, Cadillac Blues. Been coming here since I was a kid, man, about 20 years old. This store will save you. You know, like when you're doing gigs down the street, you break something, you run in here real fast, pick it up, then you finish the gig. Yeah, they're closing for good. Sad.
You want me to bring those two guitars down, the limited edition ones?
Well, I want to pick your brain about some electronics.
It's the latest victim. Businesses are suffering, especially as smaller independent businesses. I've been working here 8 years, and it's been a wonderful, wonderful place. I got a great boss and great store, and we're sad to go.
Put this back up there, and let me start. I'm going to buy other shit. I'm buying all kinds of stuff.
My name is Sarah Purser. We live really close by, and we've been going there for years. Finding out the store was closing, we wanted to give as much support as we could.
Some drums and some cymbals.
Do you want to play me something on the guitar?
The store's closing, and you know, there was a few newspaper articles saying there might be some good prices, so I think people are converging for that. Honestly, the store was always overpriced, so as a local musician, I didn't come here too often, just being real.
Erica Zinter.
What brings you down here today?
We're on vacation from New Hampshire.
Did you know today was the closing?
We didn't know it was the closing, but my son, who's a musician, knew about the store, so wanted to come to the store, and it turns out that they're having this big sale and they're closing.
Are you glad you made it here?
I am, yes.
What are you going to buy?
Buy this envelope filter so I can sound like Jerry Garcia.
Mm-hmm.
Those sounds were gathered by KALW's Ariella Markowitz at a liquidation sale at the Haight-Ashbury Music Center. Now, the store will soon shut down for good, but you can still find musical gear. Owner Masoud Badakhshan has another music shop in Redwood City called Gelb Music. And the Haight-Ashbury Music Center will live on as an online marketplace for instruments. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. We were just on Haight Street, home to some of the most memorable sounds in rock and roll history. But the great musicians who used to play there, and still do for that matter, well, they'd be making no sound at all if it weren't for the people who make the guitars. KALW's Ben Trefney talked to one of those people behind the music.
It used to be that if you wanted to learn how to make a guitar, you had to apprentice with a luthier, someone who makes stringed instruments. You'd find them in Europe, and you had almost no other option, until a New Yorker wrote the book on high-end construction.
Irving Sloan, Classic Guitar Construction. Diagrams, photographs, and step-by-step instructions.
I have a 2-year list of commissions, and so there's always a guitar to build.
When he was in his early 20s, Alan Perlman got the book, and he began exploring what it takes to make a guitar. There's interest.
I've always enjoyed working with my hands.
Then diligence.
Right. Almost everything can be repaired, and yeah.
And passion.
The first guitar I gave away to a beautiful woman.
Did she like the guitar?
She liked the guitar.
Did she like you?
Yeah, but she's living in Bolivia.
Alan and I are in his studio. It's way out by the windswept ocean in San Francisco's Sunset District. It's a small room in the back of the house he shares with his wife, Sue. There's a west-facing window, a wall full of tools, and several guitars hanging from the ceiling.
It's probably the safest way, especially in earthquake country. If anything happened, they would just swing.
Alan has crafted more than 200 guitars. They sell for up to $13,000. But mostly, he fixes them.
Yeah, it's completely variable. Yeah.
What's the most expensive repair you've ever done?
$25,000.
Wow. How much was that guitar worth?
About 6 times that. I'll get these surprise emails or phone calls that, like, the best recent example is Paul Simon, a call from his repairman saying they wanted to send one of his favorite guitars that he's had since he was 18 over for full restoration.
Alan also does a lot of work for collectors. He just finished restoring a guitar built in 1867.
Yeah, people have astonishing numbers of really expensive guitars. It's really something. I have one client who owns about 120. And
why have so many guitars?
In the larger, he's probably listening to this, but great, enjoy it. There's something called GAS, which is guitar acquisition syndrome. So in the really large number, it's that.
That's an awesome acronym.
It's very, really fitting.
Contents. Introduction. Construction theory. Fan bracing. Humidity.
To do a repair, Alan sometimes has to take a guitar apart. He'll remove the neck or fretboard from the body of the instrument.
And drill 2 small holes through the fret slot. And then I have what is basically a basketball inflation valve hooked up to a cappuccino maker.
Sorry.
That's all right. And
That's a homemade machine there.
Yeah. And I'll use that to pump steam into that. And as that joint loosens, clamp it out and remove it.
I mean, that's a brilliant invention.
Well, I don't think I'm the first, but it's...
The luthier's homemade tool.
Yeah. Yeah, we have a lot of homemade tools.
If a job requires replacing or creating wood for the body of the guitar, Alan heads to his wood shop downstairs.
Okay, we are in my garage now. That's a sawdust collector. And that's the bandsaw. Next, I would run those woods through a thicknessing sander, and the sound of that.
This is a noisy room.
I usually wear headphones when I'm working.
The guitar maker's basic job, then, is to make a guitar thin enough to produce adequate volume, stable enough to preclude harmonic difficulties, and with a top that will flex properly to lend body and presence to the sound. This golden mean is what the luthier strives for. How to achieve it cannot be reduced to a pat formula. A systematic study of the great maker's guitars reveals subtle changes in thicknesses and dimensions from one instrument to the next. No two are the same.
The guitar tops are most often spruce, and the resins in spruce are kind of gummy, sappy at the first part of their life, and then they crystallize, and that really helps tone. And the other more mysterious part is that playing instruments improves the tone, and there's even a device that we fasten onto our guitars that just vibrates them for days on end and helps partially simulate the effects of age. But still, there's nothing that can duplicate the age, and that's a really good argument for keeping things for a long time.
Alan is a person who believes in taking his time. In an age of instant access, the internet at our fingertips, he has no Yelp page, no Twitter. Rather, he relies on word-of-mouth references. And he's not into instant gratification. Some jobs take years to complete. Some things take decades to learn. Technology can only take you so far. But then again...
See, look, you're using technology.
Oh, yeah.
You've got your guitar tuner app.
Yeah. This is the pro version. I hate to say it blows my $300 strobe tuner out of the water. But...
A guitar from the hand of a skilled luthier is always a revelation. The tone, action, craftsmanship, and finish make playing such an instrument a unique pleasure.
Out of all the guitars he's built, Alan has a favorite.
There is an 11-string guitar that I built for a guitarist named James Klein. And to hear him play this in concert was one of the most exquisite moments. And like, those are actually the moments that I live for, to hear people playing these instruments and what it sounds like to go to the back of a hall and listen.
The classic guitar is a delicate equation, painstakingly conceived to produce a brilliant, balanced tone over its entire playable range. The story of the great guitar makers is the story of a quest for this perfection. The secret of the men who have succeeded in mastering this equation is simply the skill born of infinite patience and the knowledge born of experience.
What does it take to make a musical instrument? Interest. Diligence. Passion, study, patience, experience, and maybe most valuable of all, slowing down to listen. In San Francisco, I'm Ben Trefney for Cross Currents.
Great. So tell me about this guitar.
This guitar is a small-bodied steel string that's made out of wondrous metal.
Thanks, Ben. You can find that story and all of our arts coverage online at kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. So Ben and our news team were thinking about the closure of the Haight-Ashbury Music Center and about the work of artisans like Alan Perlman. And we were wondering about the current state of craftsmanship in the Bay Area and beyond. That led us to think of Todd Oppenheimer. He is a longtime San Franciscan who runs the Craftsmanship Initiative. Its mission is to, quote, shine a light on people dedicated to reclaiming craftsmanship's principles of excellence, beauty, and durability as a pathway to a better world, unquote. Todd publishes articles from around the globe in a quarterly online magazine called Craftsmanship. KALW's Ben Trefney spoke with him earlier today.
Your cover story right now is about a town in Mexico that's famous for making guitars. Can you tell me about the town of Paracho?
Yeah, Paracho has been around for a long time, very small town, and it is part of a collection of towns founded by a Spanish bishop in the 1500s. He had the brilliant idea that there should be an organized collection of towns that concentrated on different crafts, from coppersmithing to ceramics to making implements out of the indigenous reeds and plants and various things. And Paracho was either asked to, or I think may have already been somewhat in this direction already, concentrate on string instruments. So that's been their history for a long time. And so the town, just about everybody in the town is employed in one way or another in making primarily guitars, almost exclusively guitars. And they got put on the map a year or more ago when the Disney Pixar film Coco came out, because the white guitar that has become sort of iconic in that movie was made in Paracho.
So writers for your magazine and you yourself travel around the world like that, meeting master craftspeople. I'm wondering if you could give me a couple more examples of some of the extraordinary people that you've met through that work.
Oh, yeah, we've been very lucky. I think probably our best examples are in Italy, particularly Venice. I have an extremely talented writer there named Erla Zwingel, who spent her career writing for National Geographic, and she has brought us incredible stories, one of her most recent on a man named Marino Menegazzo. He is the last true master maker of gold leaf. We've also been in Japan and written about really fascinating, obscure craft of making fishing poles out of bamboo and the masters of that craft. And they sell their poles when they're at their best for, you know, tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. And it's just amazing. And some of them are very small, because it turns out in Japan, the master fishermen are actually fishing for small fish because they're so hard to catch. So they make these small poles so you can catch small fish. It's pretty funny.
So, you know, you talk about the cost of those fishing poles as being extremely high. Is craftsmanship generally for sort of a high-end market? Does it kind of necessarily need to be in order for people to be able to make a living out of selling such beautiful creations?
That's a great question. We tangle with it all the time. And there are definitely crafts where that's the case. The fishing poles are a good example of that. And partly as a result of that, in Japan, the fishing pole craft is a good example. A lot of these old masters are kind of giving up. They're not taking on apprentices quite consciously. In Japan, it's extremely difficult to apprentice in that trade. The master's just very discouraged about the prospects of the future of that craft, I think partly because of the quality of the bamboo is declining. But the work in so many of these crafts requires incredible patience and time that young people are not too interested in. But to the heart of your question, the answer is twofold. On one hand, yes, a lot of these crafts are getting so expensive that only the wealthy can afford them. On the other hand, in many cases, the products of artisans, the fishing poles is extreme, but the products of artisans who are at the top of their trade and selling their best are no more expensive and sometimes less expensive than the highest end version that is industrially made. I think a couple of the best examples of that, one we have written about, is leather bags. You know, Gucci and Hermes and any name brand you can think of. If you go to buy a nice leather bag, a woman's bag or a men's wallet or any of those, you know, leather goods by those brands, they're a fortune. They're an absolute fortune. They're perfectly good. But the stitching is not hand done, and there is a virtue to hand stitching aside from the romanticism of it. There's a process that you go through to hand stitch leather that makes it extremely strong and will make it hold up a lot longer than machine stitched. There's a woman in San Francisco we've written about in the Richmond District on Clement Street named Beatrice Amblard, and she teaches classes, and she was trained by Hermès, and she makes bags that are as good as, if not better than, the bags you could buy down in Saks by Hermès for maybe two-thirds the price. So there's an example. Hats are the same way. Stetson and the big names sell their hats for a fortune. You could get a hat custom shaped for your head out of the same materials and perhaps better materials for less. So shoes, similar.
How is that?
The reason is primarily marketing and just, you know, insurance and everything else. I mean, if you run Hermes or Gucci's or any of these name brands, think of the costs you have for employment and for marketing in particular. You know, any big brand name spends a fortune on advertising and marketing. And our culture right now is so permeated by mass production and electronic versions of something, or even if not electronic, very throwaway items. I mean, the whole concept of getting something repaired has almost disappeared, which is horrible for a lot of reasons. It's wasteful financially and it's wasteful resource-wise. And the digital, everybody on their phones and computers that have to get upgraded every 2 years doesn't help. The prevalence of mass-produced stuff, the buying of things off Amazon or wherever else you go for your mass-produced items. I mean, when I bought my wife a guitar, I didn't even think to look at the Haight-Ashbury Music Center. I went to the Guitar Center on Van Ness, got a perfectly good guitar, only to find out later that it at Haight-Ashbury, or there's another shop south of Market, I could have bought a much, much better guitar for less that was barely used, you know, and in very good shape. I just didn't even know about it. That's because big brand stores have dominated our consumer culture.
So what would you like to see people do around the concept of, I guess ultimately it's purchasing, but, you know, in this idea about supporting craftsmanship, which obviously you care very deeply about?
I would like to see people return to the notion of buying something that is meant to last and doing the research required to see if it's built to last. That used to be the concept that guided American industrial health and progress. So part of it is a shift in consciousness that used to exist. When people bought things that were made to last, they kept them for their lifetime, passed them on to their children and grandchildren. We've gotten away from that ethic. But if you do that, if you shop that way, you actually save money by buying the best.
That's Todd Oppenheimer, founder and executive director of the Craftsmanship Initiative. He spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney. You can find Todd's work and that of his writers around the world. We've got a link online at kalw.org. And while you're there, make sure you're subscribed to the Cross Currents newsletter. Get all our interviews, all our stories, and more in your inbox every week. Tune in tomorrow at 5. Bay Area readers express how Toni Morrison's work changed their lives.
If you didn't, when you read her, find out something about yourself, you weren't listening.
Storytelling to soothe the soul, tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents.
Searching for me.
This music is by Valerie Trout from Oakland. She's performing at the summertime concert series called Third Thursdays at Latham Square this week.
Feeling strange. Life is changing.
Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Sophie Codner, Lisa Morehouse, Adriana Morga, True Gwynn, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Jocelyn Tabankai. Our engineers are James Rowlands, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.
Sometimes I wish that you would kiss all my fears away, away, just to renew my faith, yeah. Back on the road, searching for me.